Montoya, our drummer, as he does every week, kicks off our theme song here on Spectrum West. Hi, everybody. I'm Al Ross. It's the 9th day of December. It's chilly outside, 6 and a half after 5 o'clock. Welcome. We're going to talk about the arts, the music, and humanities that we enjoy prolifically here in West Wisconsin. Today, the physician who, in addition to things medical, specializes in kiln-formed glass, Steve Immerman, is here. A poet who is self-taught by experience, Jeanette Robbins, will join us to talk about a new book and a reading event. Jill Jane is called the Rockstar Nutritionist. She's coming to Eau Claire next week for entertainment and information. For our youngsters, she'll be here via phone from the road. Jim Oliver is here with his weekly on-stage listing of what's playing at theater venues in West Wisconsin. Let's check something on the Spectrum memo. Tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock, Gantner Concert Hall at UW Eau Claire hosts the winter concert of the Chippewa Valley Youth Symphony. Dr. Peter Haberman and crew will have a very special event planned for you, so if you can make it, do so. Let's get underway with this audio magazine with the aforementioned Jim Oliver. He has a couple special guests waiting to talk about how what they do is designed to entertain us all.
Jane Jeffries teaches English at the University of Wisconsin-Stout. Jim Jeffries teaches history and government at North High School in Eau Claire. Jane and Jim Jeffries have been writing plays together since 1995, and they're still married. They've published 9 plays so far. They also sell Madrigal dinner scripts online. Their scripts have been performed in 40 states and internationally in Canada and Guatemala. Their latest composition, Christmas Present, will open next Friday and will play through Sunday the 18th at the Heide Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. The Jeffries join us today to talk about Christmas Present and perhaps share their secret for coexisting in an artistic endeavor where egos often get in the way. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Thanks.
Well, let's start first of all. Let's get this out of the way. Tell us what Christmas Present is about.
We take a look at Bible stories, and because they're in the Bible, we never really take a look at how really strange they are. I mean, if you take a look at the Nativity story, if you've got Zechariah and Elizabeth, you've got a woman in her 70s or 80s who's pregnant. And we read that and don't think anything of it because we're used to it. You know, and we imagine what would happen if all this happened today and we put it in a modern context. So, you know, Elizabeth, who's 76 and pregnant, is in an assisted living facility. And when she goes into labor, you can imagine some interesting reactions are going to happen. We've got the wise men who are businessmen from the East who are looking for the one. They're expecting some big businessman instead of a little baby. We've got Shepherd's, which is a fast food restaurant, which specializes in shepherd's pies, that the angels come and visit through the drive-thru. And we've got the innkeeper's tale, because, you know, the innkeeper, let's face it, gets a bad rap. Everybody looks at him and says, you put him in the stable out back? But this is during a census. I mean, the place was packed. The guy was really pretty generous. I mean, he rented out his own room. And so we try to recreate that with the Star Trek convention going on at the hotel so they don't have room for Mary and Joseph.
So who's in the cast?
We have about probably 48 or 50 in the cast.
Oh, really? Oh, just give me some of the principal characters then.
Well, we could start with the three wise guys, our wise men. But there are three CEOs from the East. And so we have Jane Lapointe Kilgallen. She's Demure. And we have Brad Henderson. He's Harry Gold. Ken Walden is Frank Incense.
So the names are Frank Incense, Gold, and Demure.
Okay.
I know, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe I shouldn't have said that out loud.
Well, maybe you spoiled the whole thing.
Yeah.
I've been reading up on you folks, and it's terribly interesting stuff to me. How did you get started writing plays or madrigals? Which came first, by the way, the madrigals or the plays?
The madrigals came first.
Oh, okay.
I was teaching at Eau Claire Christian High School. It was a small school in town, and they didn't really have any money a lot of times. And so they had a madrigal dinner, and our choir teacher left, so I took it over and sort of turned it into what we called a medieval dinner instead. We'd order our plays from a guy in Minnesota, and they were fun, but I had a lot of students in the cast, so we would always write side bits so that we had enough roles for all of the students. So over time, we thought, Everybody's laughing. I think we can do just as well. Why don't we just try to write our own?
And they're laughing at the right spots, too, which, you know, was interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's how we got our start.
Mm-hmm. So that was in 1995. So then you started writing plays, or which one of you started writing the plays, or do you do those together as well?
Oh, we do those together as well. It sort of evolved where we had a magical play that didn't really work as a magical play. And so my wife sent it in on a lark to a publishing company, and you know, they accepted it the first time. You're supposed to pay your dues before you're published.
We were just too stupid to fail.
You've got companies that are too big to fail. We were too stupid to fail, and we just figure stupidity is the best policy, and we've been going that way ever since.
Why don't you describe what is the difference between a madrigal and a play, then?
Madrigal dinner, they have several of those in town. You know, a Renaissance theme. Usually the focus is on the singers itself. So like Memorial High School and the university both have one. But they also have a, you know, sort of a set outline through the evening with the wassail and bringing in the boar's head and everything. And then they have a show at the end. It's a comedy. We just started writing those after, you know, we were working at my school. And so then we thought, well, it's the internet world. Let's put up a website and see if we can sell them. So we did.
And we were sort of lucky in that we were able to test out some of our plays at the Renaissance Festival. And what's great about a Renaissance Festival, if they don't like your play, they will leave, as we know, in droves. So we found out which parts were sort of slow moving by the audience, you know, dwindling down to one. Mm-hmm. So we learned to make them really fast paced in order to keep the audience.
He is Jim and she is Jane. They're the Jeffreys. They've written Christmas Present, which will be presented next Friday through Sunday at the Heide Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. How do you divide the writing? How does this all work?
Well, this is the way it works. I'm responsible for personally crafting with loving care each joke, each pun, and each bit of slapstick humor. Jane takes care of the rest of the unimportant stuff like plot, character development, making sure the play makes sense. Uh-huh. And that's been working for us for quite some time.
So, Jane, that's why you're the president and he isn't. Is that the story?
Let's go with that. Yeah. Yeah, I like that.
Okay. Now, you have a daughter who's involved as well.
She does everything I used to do. I was just a lackey, and now I'm the senior lackey, now that my daughter is junior lackey, and she takes care of organizing the plays and getting them off to the customers, and she's also written four plays so far. Usually inheriting our sense of humor is a handicap that sort of prevents you from fitting into society, but she's found a way to make it work for her.
That's certainly encouraging for her, I'm sure. You are co-directing this show. Do you co-direct all your plays then when you do them?
Is this the first one we've actually directed together?
Yeah, I've directed some plays without Jane, and Jane's directed some plays without me.
Yeah, so I think this is the first time we've actually worked together.
No. A Tale of Two Tales we co-directed.
Okay, second time.
So one directs, and what does the other one do then when you don't co-direct?
Well, usually we are stronger in different areas. Like I'm pretty good at physical comedy and how to deliver comedy lines. And Jane's got the bigger picture of how the play should come together and where people should be positioned on the stage.
And it's been nice with this show because it's in different scenes. And so he's been running one upstairs and I've been running one downstairs. So that's worked really well.
Talk a little bit about your business, for want of a better term. You have a webpage and you market your madrigals, also your plays, too, online?
Well, the plays we sell through other publishers.
So they do the marketing for us.
The madrigals, medieval dinners, we sell. And what's great about the internet age is you just put a website up and people beat a path to your door. I mean, that's been just great.
Google madrigal dinners, and there aren't that many people out there writing madrigal dinners. So.
Not that we want any more people writing madrigal dinners. We think the market is saturated, and it's not a very good opportunity for the enterprising businessman.
Well, do you have a strategy? I noticed that you, in some of your advanced publicity, you were talking about the fact that you were really bummed out about only having been produced in 40 states.
Do you have a strategy? 10 states, for some reason. I mean, what is up with Hawaii? I mean, I think if we have a magical dinner involving grass skirts, I think we could open up that market. And it's weird, it sort of makes a belt across the United States.
Yeah, we didn't get Kentucky yet, right?
We haven't gotten Kentucky yet.
It's just kind of irritating when we're from Indiana. But
They see we're from Indiana, and that's why
there's always some rivalries going on.
A little bit of rivalry.
Yeah, so you're both from Indiana, and I asked you earlier how you wound up in Eau Claire, which I think is interesting.
I got my teaching certification. I just put resumes everywhere, and there was the city called Eau Claire, which said, come on up for an interview. And I didn't want to go, and Jane said, oh, why not? We've never been to Wisconsin.
Just take a vacation.
Take a vacation. It was July. It was 98 degrees, and we came up, and it was 80 degrees.
Gorgeous.
Gorgeous. No humidity. And the rivers, you could see down more than 3 inches into the river. And it wasn't on fire. The Ohio River caught on fire once while I was living there. I always wondered how you put out a river. But anyway, we were there, and we thought we had come to paradise. When they offered me the job, I immediately said yes. And then February hit. And then March. Mm-hmm. And then April. And then May. How long does winter last here?
Mm-hmm. Well, as long as it feels like it, it sounds, yes.
So. Yeah. But we survived.
And like it here now.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Well, we've been visiting with Jim and Jane Jeffries, whose play, Christmas Present, will be presented beginning next Friday through Sunday at the Heide Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. For ticket information, you may use your favorite search engine to find the Heide Center for the Arts. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And thank you, Jim Oliver, for another stellar performance. 18, well, he's having a conversation. I don't want people that are interviewed by Jim to think he's just acting. 18 minutes after 5, this is Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Thanks so much for being here with us today.
Support for WPR comes from the Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra. Soprano Mitra Sadegpour and the wannabe conductor winner joined the symphony for Tis the Season, Take 2, December 17th at Eau Claire Memorial High School. Tickets at cvsymphony.org.
Yes, sir. Thanks very much. You know, when your nose is close to the stove where entertainment things are cooking in West Wisconsin, you hear things. And I have it on good faith that tomorrow, a little bird told me, around 5 o'clock, out at Oakwood Mall in Eau Claire, probably in the food court area, there might be something big going on. That's about all I was told, and I'm as intrigued as you are, and I'm going to show up just because I am that intrigued about it. We'll have some more stuff on the Spectrum Memo coming up as Spectrum West continues. For now, though, she lives in Eau Claire but has been around geographically and within many interesting and varied life experiences, and for much of that life she has written about what's going on around her in a perspective that's unique. She has a new book of verse on the market and a special event coming up, the details of which we'll get to. But for now, let's get to know Jeanette Robbins.
I started writing my poetry when I was about 14.
Which is just a couple years ago, probably.
Oh, yes. I don't know. I have a lot of passion and love in my heart. I just wanted to share it in some way, and so I started writing my poetry. And I kind of held on to it for years and just kept it in a file. And then when the MySpace came out and was very popular, my kids said, maybe you should do some things. Well, I didn't know what to do on there, so I started writing my poetry on a blog and not thinking anybody was really going to see it. It was mainly for me, and I found it was easier to type than it was to actually write, so I could write poetry a lot faster. And I'm very much a night person, so I would be up late at night writing 2 or 3 poems and adding it to this blog. Well, before I knew it, people from all over the world, as far as India and Australia, were becoming fans of this poetry. And at one point, I had to take a break from it. And when I got back, I was bombarded with emails, and a few of these people were very perturbed. They were wanting to know, where's the poetry? And it just comes naturally for me to write it, but it seemed to have an effect. And I thought, in this day and age, people could benefit from this.
Were you schooled in poetry, or did you just started writing as a teenager?
Never schooled in poetry or writing of any sort.
And I see what you mean about working on a keyboard. Yes. I like to write on legal pads, but, you know, I've been doing what I do so long now on computers that my handwriting has really gone in the dumper. And many times I can't read what I wrote. The focus of our conversation today is the writing compilation that's entitled Angel's Mirth, for which, as you said, you collected things you had written over the years. It's a little bit of a roller coaster ride to read your stuff. I mean, some of it is mirthier than others.
Yes.
Did you observe and recall stuff as you compiled poems over the years? Is this about the stages of your life, or what have you written about?
Some of it is the stages of my life, but quite a bit of it is my, I guess, inner philosophy on life, my truth or my world that I live in.
Your world has changed, obviously, since you were 14. And so what you write about must have changed, yes?
Yes, it has a bit.
Are you kind of the same person that you
I'm always the same person. I feel like I'm going to be 48 here in December, and I feel like I'm still 12 years old.
Oh, yeah?
But I'm supposed to be a little, quote, you know, smarter or whatever, but I pretty much try to keep my nature the same and, you know, add on some things that you learn in life, but to try to keep that core steady and the same.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the title, Angel's Mirth, because the way it's written, the word angel is singular. So are you talking about you, an angel, or are you talking about another angel? And does mirth describe the way you look at life?
First, I wanted to have a little bit of a description and say that I'm not a religious person. I embrace all religions. There's a common thread in them all at the core.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I guess my religion is love. And that's what I consider God to be. And so when I speak of God or angels in my book, to me, angels are, you know, the definition is a messenger of God. Or messengers of God. To me, it's the extension of love. I'm referring to all the angels, I guess, all the positive energy of love and giving and compassion.
Do you believe in angels? Do you think there are angels out there,
angels? I think the common belief for most people, they're so varied. Some people will winged creatures, a little whisper in your ear, a stranger that you meet could be an angel. I kind of embrace them all. What I think about an angel is that there are other existences that we can't see. I do firmly believe that. And I think those soft whispers or positive energy or guardians are just givers of love, and that love and grace is always there for people to just kind of grab. And I think that angels or this positive energy has got a lot of gook to go through for us to get this energy, because this is a world of matter and mind.
It's a pretty good time of year to be thinking about angels, too. I mean,
yes,
they're around all over the place.
Yes.
Hanging from light poles and going around over the candles in our
homes.
Our guest today is Jeanette Robbins, poet, also an artist.
Yes.
I guess we can call you an entrepreneur as well. Specifically, Angel's Mirth is the book, and we're going to talk about an event that's coming up in about a week in Eau Claire. As we work to continue to define Jeanette Robbins, it's probably a good idea for us to hear something that you've written. So why don't you set up a poem, and we'll get on to another one a little later.
The first one I'm going to read is called Gifts Within My Heart, and it's from the Love chapter.
Okay.
If I could send you a gift so fine to share my heart of love divine, I'd fetch the stars from the sky, each and every one sparkling and sublime. I'd place them in a basket anointed with my tears. A very special basket must hold this love so dear. I'd weave it with my kisses, oh so tenderly, and set a wish upon it to bring my love to me. I'd add the finest gold that all the world may hold, and every flawless diamond ever seen in all the land. I'd place them in my basket, lovingly, watching as they left my hand. Rubies, sapphires, and emeralds, jewels of red, green, and blue, faceted with perfection, only the most beautiful will I send to you. I would gather for you the rarest of pearls and empty out the sea, and set a wish upon them, to bring my love to me. I'd handpick every flower, roses, lilacs, and tulips, too. The most fragrant and most beautiful only will I send to you. I hope you love your basket of gifts, none the more beautiful ever to be. I set a wish upon them in tears. Please bring my love to me.
That's very nice.
Thank you.
And we'll have another one in a moment, but let's talk about the event that's coming up on Wednesday, December 14th. It's pretty big for you, isn't it?
Yes, I'm very, very excited. I'm quite nervous. It's going to be a book opening event. There'll be books available to purchase and have signed there. There'll be classical acoustic music. I'm going to be reading some of my poetry and sharing a little bit of my inspiration for the book. And then I'm going to do something fun at the end, because at the end of my chapters, I have a section that's for children and adults, and it's my whimsical section, and I have some nonsensical rhymes in there. And I'm going to have fun with that and do an interactive contest. So whoever has the best nonsensical rhyme gets a free copy for Christmas of my book.
So it will be a mirthy event.
Well, I hope so. Inspirational, mirthy, a little bit of everything, just like the book is. It's kind of a little bit of everything. And the books are also available at angelsmirth.com, limited signed copies, and they're also available at the local store for volume one, and also at amazon.com as an ebook.
Briefly, let's talk about how you name poems, because many times that's almost tougher than writing the poem itself, isn't it?
Yes, it's very difficult. I do not pick a title first. Sometimes when you do that, the title won't be very romantic sounding. And I think in poetry, you need to have that flowing romantic energy about it. And
sure.
So it's more difficult, I think, to title them than it is to actually write them.
Okay, so you have another title.
I'm going to read one that's actually going to be a children's book, and it's called The Artist. If I could paint the world, I think, perhaps I'd paint a few clouds pink. I would raise my brush real high, you see, and swish, let it paint the sky, I think. Maybe purple, maybe yellow, whatever I felt at the time. Sometimes I'd be silly and mix some things about, like legs on trees and talking bees, or flowers that scream and shout. The moon in my clever scheme one day might be olive green, and the stars would be for me quite near, so I could see them bright and clear. I'd paint them vibrant colors, then watch them glisten and shimmer. With brush in hand, my world is grand, for I've painted a smile upon every man. Sounds of happiness and peace created all around, such a peaceful sound, like the gentle cooing of doves. As the final masterpiece I paint would be all hearts filled with love.
There you go, Jeanette Robbins. The illustrations in the book are mostly hers as well. The event, again, is on the 14th, and it's at the Acoustic Cafe in downtown Eau Claire. Well, the Harp Ensemble presents the annual holiday harp concert at the Chippewa Valley Museum Sunday at 2 p.m. That's in Carson Park in Eau Claire. We'll have more Spectrum Memoranda coming up later. For right now, though, coming up after a news flash, it's Jill Jane, the rockstar nutritionist, bringing the Jumping with Jill show to Eau Claire schools this coming week. And well-known glass artist Steve Immerman brings his art to the L.A. Phillips Memorial Public Library and some of his story to Spectrum West. We'll be back after the news. And you are now informed. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Al Ross. Welcome back to Spectrum West. Here's another memo. Tonight at the Old Gem Theater in New Richmond, it's jazz standards, holiday music, and more with Christine Rushell. It all gets underway at 8 o'clock. Also, tonight at the Heidi Center, it's a Christmas evening with String Ties and Danville. The music begins at 7. That sounds fun. Right now, Spectrum West continues with another Oliver offering. Here's Jim.
Here's what's on stage this weekend and beyond at Western Wisconsin theater venues. The Eau Claire Children's Theater will present A Winnie the Pooh Christmas Tale tonight, Saturday and Sunday. The Ork Nativity will be performed tonight, Saturday and Sunday at the Northern Star Theater in Rice Lake. Cumberland ETC is performing All Through the House tonight and Saturday. Inspecting Carol will be performed tonight and Saturday at the St. Croix Festival Theater. The Maskers Theater Organization at the University of Wisconsin River Falls will present The Boys Next Door tonight and Saturday and next Thursday through Saturday at the Blanche Davis Theater at the University. Fuddy Mears will be performed tonight, Saturday, and Sunday by the Music and Theater Department at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. The production will be staged at the Riverside Theater in the Haas Fine Arts Center at the University. The Old Gem Theater in New Richmond will perform a Laura Ingalls Wilder Christmas on the Prairie at 10:30 a.m. Saturday and 2 p.m. Sunday. O. Henry Christmas will be performed at the Theater in the Woods tonight, Saturday, and Sunday at the Erica Quam Memorial Theater in Shell Lake. The University of Wisconsin Stout Theater will present The Underpants tonight and Saturday at Harvey Hall Theater at the University in Menominee. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild is presenting It's a Wonderful Life, a live radio play tonight, Saturday and Sunday, and next Thursday, Friday, Saturday and Sunday at the Grand Little Theater in Eau Claire. The Space Center for Creativity in New Richmond is also presenting a dinner theater production of It's a Wonderful Life, a live radio play tonight and Saturday. Don't Hug Me, I'm Pregnant runs tonight and Saturday at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. The show will run through January 7th. A Very Rudyful Christmas runs tonight, Saturday, and Sunday at the Fanny Hill Dinner Theater in Eau Claire. The show runs through January 15th. And that's some of what's happening in theaters around the region. I'm Jim Oliver.
Yes, you are. Thank you, sir. Here's another reminder. Tomorrow night, 7:30 at the Northern Lakes Center for the Arts in Amory, Joy to the World, readings and carols accompanied by the Northern Lakes Chamber Orchestra. This is Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Thanks for joining us today. This is all about the arts, the music, the humanities. We find so very often here in Western Wisconsin. Let's now talk about the woman with two first names. Her name is Jill Jane. And when you hear about her schedule and what's involved in what she does, it all might make sense because she has the energy of two people. She's the rock star nutritionist, making musical sense to kids about how important good health and good nutrition are, especially in this day and age of sedentary lifestyles due to our proclivity for sitting in front of entertainment screens. She's coming to Eau Claire next week, and when I convinced her to sit still long enough to talk, she was on the road, having just completed a Play 60 event with the Buffalo Bills football team. As you were honing your skills as a musician and an actress, and then eventually as a nutritionist, when did the light go on that pointed the way to what you're doing now?
Well, it was very much of an evolution. In high school, I was the athlete and the jock, but I was also in the musicals, and I was also a really good student. And then in college, I studied nutrition, and I was in a band, and I was in all the shows that we did. And then I moved to New York City, so it was like it just kept scaling up. So then in graduate school, I was doing an MSRD program, which is my Master's in Science and Nutrition, and my registered dietitian certification. And I was acting off Broadway, and I was my band was really taking off. My first job out of college, I was on PBS. I was on a show called What's in the News. And we got a grant for childhood obesity prevention. It was sort of right when the epidemic was first being diagnosed. And I was an on-air personality and writer because they had no money. Yeah, I was willing to take any salary. And that was my first exposure to how I could combine the two. So I didn't look back. I moved to New York. And part of our practicum as students in nutrition is working with kids. And I saw my crowds with my band going nuts over my music. So why not try some of those backbeats with these New York City public school kids, to see if that would work. And, they went nuts and the teachers wanted to know where they could buy my CD. So it really kind of evolved with both my interest and my passion for nutrition, but also my experience as a performer, that I didn't just pick up a guitar one day. I've been doing this with my brother since I was like five. So it really has evolved in a very fun way that it's now my full-time job.
How long ago did we become aware of the obesity problem?
When I first started in college in 2000, childhood obesity was not the favored way of describing it. Obesity was considered a word for adults. The reason that from a scientific perspective people were thinking that way was kids are put on growth charts and they're considered in percentiles when it comes to being overweight or underweight, mm-hmm. and adults use BMI. So they were using BMI to classify kids as obese, and they said, well, you can't do that. Kids can't be overweight. And the problem with not acknowledging that problem, that there's been an increase, is that then you don't have to fund it, you don't have to treat it, you don't have to come up with solutions because it's not a problem. So we were seeing this major spike, and it wasn't until really the Surgeon General in 2001, David Satcher, said, this is a problem, we have to do something about it. And he established Action for Healthy Kids. Mm-hmm. And that was really like, whoa, the government is going to tell me what to eat. You know, this whole thing of, can we mandate changes with what people eat, how much people exercise? And we started to look at, well, we've cut all the PE programs. You know, school lunch hasn't changed in many, many years, the guidelines. So it's kind of all evolved together to definitely be diagnosed as a problem and then to get solutions to address the many aspects of the issue that affect obesity. I think when people look at obesity, still even today with it being such a hot-button issue, people look at it as a sort of lack of self-will issue, mm-hmm. that it's just, well, kids are fat, and so we need to, you know, fat people need recipes, and we'll give them recipes, and then they just need to quit eating so much. It turns out that with all this exposure, both from a policy aspect, we're looking at the problem from a physical education standpoint, from a school lunch standpoint, from an education standpoint, and we're sort of trying to connect the dots to make a whole child improvement in the way that we approach this. So it's been a really great ride from my perspective over the last decade.
Our guest is Jill Jane. It's called Jump with Jill. She's noted as a rock star nutritionist. The program on which we're speaking is called Spectrum West, and it deals weekly with the arts, music, and entertainment. That's the reason I thought it would be cool to talk with you, because it's a timely topic, but it also, you have an entertainment factor.
Yeah, we were just considered for a Grammy nomination this year.
Cool.
Yeah, so we're definitely, like, we don't mess around. We aren't just making kiddie music. When I hit the studio, I am really trying to make a record that kids are going to learn from and they're going to like and they're going to sing to, but the parents aren't going to beat their head against the dashboard when they have to hear it. It's a really fine line when it comes to kids' music, because the production costs of making music are so high that I have all these unique tools at my disposal, including my brother on metal guitar and my producer who does fantastic burp sound. You know, these are things you need in kids' music that you just completely underestimate, and we really try and capture all of that with live musicians and live kids singing. So I really try and make music at the absolute top echelon so that parents and kids alike will enjoy it, but then also the third bar there being learn from it. Mm-hmm. That's kind of my underlying secret recipe, my evil plan to get the music to function as a teaching tool.
Mm-hmm. What are you actually telling kids?
That it's your body and you live here and you're the only one that can make the choices that are really going to matter for you. So the decisions you make about food and the decisions you make about exercise, those are for you. That's not for your teacher. It's not for a grade. It's not for your parents. It's for you. It's your body. And that's how I start every show, no matter what age group I'm talking to. Mm-hmm. And from there, then I talk about what habits are those then? What choices should you be making? And I sing about vegetables, which I call superpower vegetables. And I have this Superman anthem that has a very interesting orchestral texture to it, sort of like Fall Out Boy meets Trans-Siberian Orchestra. And then I have a song called Nature's Candy, which is James Brown sort of flair, which is about eating fruit and that fruit is nature's candy and it's as sweet as candy, but it's actually good for you. Drinking lots of water and eating and drinking foods with calcium because they're good for your bones, and we do a whole bone wrap. And that's the whole premise, is that you're learning about nutrition and you're moving, you're getting down, you're actually exercising while you're listening to this music about health.
Kids, you know, they take the message that you give them, and I'm sure they hopefully walk home if they can, you know, and I'm sure they walk in the door and say, hey, wow, this is pretty cool. But they're totally dependent on their parents to buy into it as well, aren't they? I mean, they are products of what they're served.
Right, and part of what I, you know, saying that this is your body and you control everything, I mean, the reality is that parents are packing lunches, that schools are providing cafeteria food, that the store on the corner is providing certain amounts of food, that, you know, dinner is made for them. But I think the most important aspect of that main message is this, what we call in nutrition behavior theory, we call self-efficacy, the idea that I'm able to do these things that you're asking me to do. And that's the most important part of it, is that I'm excited, I'm empowered, I'm motivated. Hey, Mom, how about tonight could we have broccoli? Mm-hmm. Well, after she passes out and we pick her off the floor, you know, really getting those messages to come from kids to want these things and to ask for them and to help their parents, because we've kind of lost one to two generations around cooking, the whole idea of food preparation.
Yeah.
So if we can sort of get that back in there, you know, with, I think a lot with the women's movement, lots of great things have come with it, but the idea that food is empowering instead of a punishment, right? It's, you know, I have to cook, you know, that being such a bad thing. But that actually when you control what you put in your food, actually you control your, you know, what happens to your body and how much energy you have, and looking at it, framing that value a little bit differently. So it is true that kids don't control everything that is put in front of them, but encouraging kids to ask for those things and to advocate for change within their communities, again, back to Fuel to Play 60, these schools have to apply for these grants. They have to sort of volunteer themselves to be a part of these campaigns. They've been chosen by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board to be a part of this, but those schools have to do a lot of work to participate and to get the show and to, like, they have to do things within their schools and ask for these changes. And that advocacy within schools has been such an exciting thing that I've seen within the past 5 years, these changes within schools of saying, well, we can't do that. Our vendors or our PTA, well, it turns out that the vendors are making healthier food, that the PTA is advocating for, you know, healthy assemblies like what we're doing. The Fuel to Play 60 is asking schools to get on board. So it's true, but it's only half true because the kids are part of a larger system.
Her name is Jill Jane. It's called Jump with Jill. That's her show. It's coming to the Eau Claire school system next week. So when your kids come home pumped about eating right and being or staying healthy, why not go along with it? And I'll bet you see some nifty changes in your lifestyle as well. Go to jumpwithjill.com for all you need to know. And if you live in Eau Claire, you'll see what kind of fun your kids will be having next week. The time is about 11 and a half before 6.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, offering Money Mission, an online simulation tool that teaches teens how to manage financial obligations. WisconsinCU.org.
Thank you, sir. This is Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Thanks for being here. Steve Immerman goes by the name Steve when he's the artist and goes by Doctor when he's in surgery. And today, thankfully, all we need is the artist. He's quite the master when it comes to working with glass and has a well-founded reputation in that medium. Right now, his work is on display in the Mezzanine Gallery at the L.A. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire. He's sharing space with Sandra Kress, whose weathered wood exhibit features digital photos enhanced. We tried to contact her, but did not get a response. No problem, though, because Dr. Immerman provided more than enough conversation to work with. We got together at the library in the midst of his work, and I began by noting that he was a native of New York and asked about if art influenced him in early life.
Yes, it did. I spent a lot of time in the Metropolitan Museum of Art as a child because my grandfather would bring me there, and his apartment was right across the street. I never really thought about art as a career, but I was always interested in school in art projects and craft projects. They fascinated me, and I never got enough of them.
When I read about his art avocation for glass, my first thought was, surgeon, good with his hands, sculpture makes sense. Then, to rob a phrase from the NFL, after further review, surgeon, hands are important, working with sharp glass. Maybe plaster or clay might be safer.
You know, as far as the dangers go, it's, you know, the edges of the glass are sharp. All of the heat to melt the glass is done inside of a closed kiln that's computer programmed, and I don't open it to manipulate it. And working with the glass, the only time you seem to get cut is when you're reaching in and out of bins trying to pick up a piece. But once you have it in your hands, you're very careful and rarely will get cut.
Medicine was Immerman's first choice, but it appears art is now a close second. I wondered about when it, in his career, it attained its lofty stature.
Even when I was a surgical resident, I was playing with stained glass, making windows, designing things. I found I really needed a creative outlet. And then once I came here and started a practice and started having children, things really got busy. And I went for several years really without having any kind of creative outlet at all. And in the mid-90s, I realized I really, really missed it, and I needed to find something, if for no other reason, as a stress reliever. And I didn't really want to go back to the stained glass because it had kind of run its course as far as I was concerned. And I had heard about this idea of melting glass in a kiln. And so I started investigating that. And it really became a bigger part of my life than I ever thought it would be. I just thought I'd be making ornaments or bowls or ashtrays in the basement, and then it would be a fairly solitary type of activity. But one day I had a piece that I had photographed, and it was on a website where other people who work in this medium display their work for each other to look at and enjoy. And it said next to it, for more information, contact the artist. And I emailed the guy who runs the website. I said, what do you mean artist? I've never been called an artist before. He goes, well, now you're an artist. And he says, I bet that was easier to get than your MD degree.
This type of work with glass is very time-consuming, yes?
It's a very slow, inefficient way of working with glass, but it lends itself to certain degrees of design that other glass forms will not allow you to do. The other ways of working with glass are, you know, glass blowing, where you're taking molten glass out of a vat and manipulating it. Torch work, where you're working with glass on a rod, using a torch to heat it up and manipulate it. Casting, where you pour molten glass into a mold. Stained glass, where you take cold glass, cut it into shapes, and let it together. This is kiln-formed glass, or fused glass, or kiln glass. It has a number of different names. With this, you take sheets of glass at room temperature, you cut them up, put them together into some sort of a construction, and then put that in a kiln and melt it so that it fuses together to be one solid piece of glass. We then still might take that and cut it up again, put it back in the kiln again, polish it, sandblast it, grind it, shape it. There's various things that we then would do with it.
That reminded me of one of my favorite questions for artists. How do you know when a piece is finished? The manipulating could go on and on. And on.
You know, with these pieces, there's a lot of planning that goes into them before you actually put them together. And so it's usually planned out to its final form from the very beginning. Certainly, there are times you get partway through and you go, this is not looking the way I wanted it to. It's just not, it doesn't look in real life like it did in my head. And you may then change courses. But most of these, you know, we start out with drawings and measurements. There's a lot of planning involved to get to the final product.
Is there a comfort level one reaches as an artist, or is it always a matter of finding more and better ways?
Always going after new techniques, new designs, new ideas, trying to infuse more meaning into the work.
Glass artist Steve Immerman is our guest. His bio lists his art as a hobby. Does that give the art enough recognition, enough stature? Is this something you can do only in your spare time, or is it important enough that you make time for it?
I do, because I enjoy it, and I think people can find time to do what they enjoy, and whether you call it a second job or a hobby or a passion or an obsession, this is something that I really do enjoy, and it helps me relax. And I feel very good when something beautiful comes out of the kiln, and I look at it and I enjoy it and I touch it and I hold it up to the light and I run upstairs and show it to my wife and I make all my kids look at it and I photograph it, and I really get a lot of enjoyment out of creating these things.
And from what I know about fused glass, sometimes what comes out of the kiln can be a surprise.
Yeah, a lot of these pieces that I create, I'm building them face down, so as I put them together, I'm not seeing the side that's going to show. Some of the glass that I use changes color once you fire it. It all definitely changes texture. The interface between the pieces of glass, everything about it changes. I can put something together and have a mental image of how it's going to end up based on, you know, 15 years of experience of putting things in the kiln and taking them out. But yeah, sometimes you're surprised that it didn't do what you wanted. Sometimes you experiment and you don't know how it's going to turn out, and you're either disappointed or pleased with what you end up with.
And where does the commercial side of art come in? Is something created with the idea it has to look a certain way because it must be appealing for sale, or is it created for the artist first?
If you make something that you think other people are going to like and it doesn't mean much to you, it probably won't excite anyone else either. And so what I make are things that I am enjoying making, that I want to see come out of the kiln, that I'm excited about. But granted, if I want to keep making these, I need to get them out of the house somehow. So it's nice to make something that someone else will want. And so the particular object is less important than the design that goes into it. Mm-hmm. Making a bowl is something people relate to very easily and can understand and would want to have. Some of the sculptural pieces, some people have a little trouble relating to as to what they would do with that. Do they really want that? Not everybody has any kind of sculpture in their home.
Immerman doesn't do a lot of exhibits, but does have his work at galleries across America, from Florida to Washington State, yes, and points in between. And because of that geographical distribution, the folks at UPS and FedEx must like this guy.
Shipping's my least favorite part of the process. Actually, the company that makes the glass that I use has a meeting every year where they teach various things. And one year they were teaching packing. And they actually had a competition where they gave groups of people a piece of glass and they said, you need to pack it so it could withstand shipping. It was thrown off a balcony that was about 30 feet off the ground. And then another 20-pound box was thrown on top of it, figuring that's about what it needs to be able to sustain in order to be shipped. And so everything I pack is packed in upholstery foam, double boxed. There's at least 4 inches of packing material between the edges of the glass and the outside world. And when I'm done packing it, I'm usually confident I could toss it down the stairs and really would not worry about it.
Kiln-formed glass artist Steve Immerman, Dr. Steve Immerman. In addition to the exhibit now up through January 10th at the Phillips Library, you can go to clearwaterglass.com. You'll find hundreds of photos of Immerman's work. Some pieces have found their way to the Janet Carson Gallery at the Eau Claire Regional Arts Center downtown as well. Well, that's going to wrap it up, folks. I'm Al Ross. Thanks for being here on Spectrum West. Next week will be our last show before our year-ender on December 30th, as the Big River Radio Wave holiday special will air at 5 p.m. on December 23rd. So be here if you can. Well, all the time. Thanks to Carly Hansen for promotional support. We'll see you next week. Have a great weekend. Stay warm.
Many Wisconsin Public Radio programs are saved for later listening at WPR.org. So, when you want to hear a program again, or you'd just like to listen when you want to, visit WPR.org and click on Audio Archives.